as we're going to get started here, our next guest is a good friend of our show. She is, if you sold out all the suicide books already, but she does have, if you're a Spanish reader and you can read Spanish, she's got a Spanish copy of the book. But that's how I was first introduced to her. She did an amazing book along with John Climo about suicide in the afterlife. And just knocked us off. It's still probably one of the most downloaded episodes we ever did of the show, and one of the ones we got the most feedback on, both loving it and hating it for the topic. But the most amazing part for me were the people that sent emails that had been on the verge of suicide, and after listening to the show, you know, wrote these beautiful, heartfelt letters about how it changed their perspective. And we've had Dr. Ethan a few times on the show. She's fantastic. So I want you guys to do me a favor. Turn off your phones. Set them on mute. Also, stop by and check out. She has two English copies of the PK Zone left at her table. And I'm busy translating one into Latin for you. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Pamela Rady.
I'm going to skip over things I've heard other people talk about. I'm not going to bore you with that again. But I will just briefly, to get us all on the same page, give a few definitions. Parapsychology is a very, very narrow, limited field. It only looks at the mind and how the mind interacts with other minds, the world around it, and whether it can possibly survive bodily death. And for those who don't know, the newer term now is mind-matter interaction. It used to be things like psychokinesis, telekinesis. And it talks about things like photography, levitation, materialization, and all kinds of wonderful poltergeist phenomena. Now, a term that I'll accidentally use a lot, so I've got to mention it in case you don't know, is the word psi. It's a general term for both ESP and mind-matter interaction. You might ask why I use that. I'm going to sort of skip ahead a little bit. And we have argued as parapsychologists for over 50 years whether these are different or the same. And traditionally, ESP is thought of as passive and receptive, and others say mind-matter interaction is active. But those who do both say they're the same thing stop using different terms. So I'll sometimes slip into using the word psi. Super ESP is the ability to know anything, anywhere, at any time. And you might say, ha, can't happen. But those of you who do remote viewing or have ever been exposed to remote viewing, this does appear to be possible. For example, Joe McMonagle visited Mars before the rover did, and a lot of the stuff he found apparently was confirmed. So it does seem to be able to do a lot of stuff. Oh, that's not going to show very well. Okay. Is there a way to dim the lights more? I have a lot of cartoons. Thank you. So is there evidence for survival? And I'm not talking about personal, first-person experience evidence, but evidence from a parapsychological standpoint. And in point of fact, when we talk about evidence for survival, we're really looking at two things. Do we, in some form, survive, since energy can be neither created nor destroyed? And is there some aspect of personality that survives? So you have a little bird up there sitting above his, above his grave, and he's saying, don't even think about it. Yeah, I think that's better. And he's too late. I don't know if you can see the little drops down there. Parapsychology got started as a science because of interest in survival. And there, as I mentioned, there's two parts to that. Now, nowadays it's interesting. It's flip-flop. From being what got parapsychology going, it's now the unwanted stepchild. And you might ask, why is that? And there is a good reason. We can't figure out how to separate two competing hypotheses. And so parapsychologists have gotten totally frustrated about this. One hypothesis says that all of the evidence we have for survival is a combination of super ESP and human mind-matter interaction. The other says we actually survive. And they have not yet been able to figure out how to separate those two. We do, however, have some suggestive evidence. We won't call it proof. Probably the strongest is on reincarnation. And Ian Stevenson was a psychiatrist from the University of Virginia. If you have not read this book, 20 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation, you have got to do so. It will change your mind about it. It certainly changed mine. He looked at children in parts of the world where there's very poor communication. A lot of these people never travel more than 5 miles from their home ever in their lifetimes. And these children do not only ID people and photos whom they hadn't met and tell entire stories of their past lifetimes, sometimes they have birthmarks related to the way they died, and sometimes they could speak an entire other language in adult form that they had never been exposed to. So these were his best cases. At this point, the University of Virginia has thousands of such cases in its database. Sometimes they're really nice and share that data too with others like myself. This is really some of the strongest evidence we have that an aspect of personality does survive. And I want to point out that it doesn't just occur in third world countries. I had a good friend who was taking her daughter to Gibraltar, and the kid suddenly starts saying, "I don't want to go there. We all died there. We all got sick and no one would let us out, and we died." And the mother didn't have a clue what she was talking about. And they get up there, and sure enough, the tour guide tells them there's a fort there, they had the plague, they wouldn't let anyone leave, and everybody died. Other evidence we have, near-death experiences. Everyone knows the stories of people who can bring back verifiable information. And one thing you don't see skeptics talk about is there's cultural variations in near-death experiences. Not everybody sees the white light. Some people see a bridge, and they go across to the island. But they argue that it's just a dying brain, and that's why you see this flash of white light. You know, you get one last burst with the optic nerve. And yet, they don't have a good explanation for out-of-body experiences. They occur in non-survival situations. They have some unique characteristics not duplicated by artificially electrically stimulating the brain, lobe areas. And a lot of people think it's one of the better pieces of evidence that near-death experiences are not a byproduct of the brain being starved by oxygen. You might ask, what about all these other things? Let's look at them. I'm very fond of Louisa Rhine. She's really one of the great women in parapsychology. And she performed literature reviews of cases sent to her with spontaneous ESP and mind matter interaction, which sometimes included apparitions of people in mortal danger or just after death. And she found something that you'll hear repeatedly in the literature. These are meaningful. This is not an arbitrary thing that, you suddenly see somebody show up. You know, they want you to know what's going on. This may be the only way they can let you know what's going on to them elsewhere. It doesn't mean they die, but they're close to death in many, many cases. They involve people who are emotionally close to you. Poltergeist case studies. Again, we've sort of covered that a little bit before. Most of the time, clearly not all of the time, it involves living individuals. Sometimes entire groups, an entire family can act as one agent. It can include apparitions artificially created. Okay, that has been reported. It usually involves repressed emotions. It can be, by the way, in any age group from a little baby to, I think the oldest was 92. It's not always teenagers. The events, again, have meaning. If you understand the when, where, and what, you'll usually understand the who and why. Events usually stop when the agent takes responsibility. And this is something that we will see again. It's called ownership resistance. It may involve unconscious fraud, and that's a really interesting one I want to sort of mention. There are times when people will fake things and they don't know they're faking things. Their conscious mind is playing a shell game, and it's, you know, their unconscious is playing a shell game with the conscious, and it's not letting the conscious mind know what it's doing. So they'll throw something behind their back and not even know they did it, literally. So you can get unconscious fraud. It doesn't mean the other stuff is fraud. The unconscious mind can be very efficient. It will use whatever is easiest. I mean, you saw the same thing with mediums. If it's easier to fake things, they'll fake things. If they can't fake things, they'll do it the real way. It can also be re-triggered with hypnosis, the role of that. And that's sort of interesting. So the unconscious mind really is in control of this. My book, PK's Own, looked at mind matter interaction experiences, and again, saw an interesting split between spontaneous events and intentional ones. With spontaneous ones, you usually saw the high emotions, like Ferry talked about, and with the more you get control over it, the more you tend to use an altered state of consciousness. To me, it's just less effort, you know, to get yourself all worked up about something. It does fulfill unconscious needs. And I'm going to say that word over and over again, unconscious. they're not always conscious of what they wanted to do. The unconscious, if you ever do hypnosis, and I recommend it, it's a skill that's useful for everybody to learn. The unconscious has its own personality and its own set of priorities. And they can be diametrically opposed to the conscious mind. It's always associated with focused awareness. I saw that in every experience I've ever looked at. But it's not always focused on the target. It can be focused on the fact you're pissed off about something or focused on something you've been thinking about, but you're focused. And it may involve the perception of time having been altered, which I'm starting to realize more and more, maybe more important than I recognized when I did that study originally. CHAM literature is not considered proof ever. Even when you have verifiable information, and this is again because of the possibility of super ESP, how do you know where you got that information? Was it from your own unconscious that got it from some kind of database, you know, universal database? Was it from a spirit that told you this information? The unconscious is the gateway. How do you know where it was before it came through your unconscious mind? We don't really have a solution for that. One thing that is clear in that suicide book is that emotional bonds continue after death, and spirits can and do have adjustment problems. They tend to perform poltergeist activity for the same reason as the living. They're upset, and they don't have another way to communicate. So they do it this way. It's the easiest way out. And you've seen this with other speakers. The question becomes, who's responsible for the events? Kenneth Batchelder is a parapsychologist from the 80s who was working with groups of ordinary individuals sitting around a table trying to make things happen. And he, by the way, those who read Owen's book, The Philip Experiments, they read about his research and were trying to repeat it. This is where they got the idea for it. He thought there were three things that block normal mind-matter interaction. One is belief or it's doubt, you know, the absence of it. One is ownership resistance. People don't like to take responsibility. You get a poltergeist agent, you explain to them they're doing it. 99% of the time, things stop cold. You know. Witness inhibition. They feel disturbed by witnessing mind-matter interaction, especially the first few times. In other words, they freak out. And how often have you seen this? They really freak out. His solution to get around these problems was to use a faked event to prime the pump. That way, people didn't have to worry about belief, because everyone believes you can fake stuff. You didn't have to worry about ownership resistance, because they just assumed it was fake. And witness inhibition. Well, this is really cool. Somebody faked this really well. But what would happen is he would fake one event and then not the ones after. And he would see a lot of real stuff starting to happen. Now, what does this tell us? Ordinary people can do mind-matter interaction, especially if you eliminate their resistance. If you have a family that doesn't think it's responsible, it makes it a lot easier to happen. Faking an event can allow real phenomena to occur. You cannot throw out the baby with the bathwater. Just because you find something faked, whether consciously or unconsciously, doesn't mean everything's fake. You really have to take each piece of evidence on its own. That is critical. Now, again, everyone else has talked about haunting investigations. I'm not going to say much about it. I've seen a lot of you people do it. You do an excellent job. A lot of times it involves comparing experiences and equipment findings, you know, and trying to see if you can cross-corroborate data. But it's still not considered proof of survival because of super ESP and the fact that you could be affecting your own equipment to get your leads. GMF levels are inversely associated with psychic phenomena. You will see, for example, spirit lights have dropped in GMF just before they appear. And, of course, magnetic fields cannot fully account for hauntings. Big surprise there. And this was a study that was presented last month at the Parapsychological Association meeting in Seattle. And Annalisa Ventola and Devin Terhune at Lund University did the study looking at photographic anomalies. So they're aware of what's going on in the paranormal community. They're like, let's look at this. This is an interesting topic. We'll look at five different types of cameras. They did a very complex study with spectral design. And they used the internet to get lots of subjects. And I know they're going to be repeating that again, so you might, you know, keep your eyes open if you want to participate in some of these studies. They used three groups: professional photographers, paranormal enthusiasts, and controls who had no haunting experience. They looked at context, whether people knew this involved a haunted house and not, you know, and not. And they looked at sites where the photos were taken. They took lots and lots and lots of photos at three different sites. They took them at active areas of a haunted house, inactive areas of a haunted house, and the house immediately next door. Okay? And then they looked at five types of film: black, white, color, digital, infrared, Polaroid. And then they put them on the internet, and they said to the subjects, rate these. How anomalous do you think these are? And they got some interesting results. First, one that didn't really surprise me, I did them a little bit. Paranormal enthusiasts are pretty sophisticated at photography. But what you'll see is the blue and the red, the lower ones, those are the paranormal enthusiasts, the photographers. They're rating things very closely together, whereas the controls rated everything higher, more anomalous. And the other thing you'll notice about this is they rated a lot of the photographs fairly similar except for infrared, and everybody thought infrared was more anomalous. Now, they also looked at the actual rating results of these photographs. They were not happy with these results, let me tell you. Because what do you see? No matter where they took the photos, they were rated pretty much the same. Didn't matter if they were rated. So they rated it equally anomalous, whether it was in an active area, an inactive area, or a control area, which was not what they were expecting. Always look results when they're not what you expect. And in fact, actively haunted areas had lower anomaly rates than inactive areas for infrared and digital images, suggesting to me they may not be your best option. This was the actual data breakdown, and I'm going to give a summary in just a second, but I just want to point out that every type of film has every type of anomaly. Okay? Just some of them are a little more notorious for certain types. For example, and I don't know why they use the word density spots. They use density spots for orbs. And they're mostly seen in digital and infrared. Light streaks are seen more with black and white. Polaroids, shadowing with color, fogging with infrared, and everything else appeared pretty equally among all the different types. They found no context effects. In other words, it didn't matter whether you told people that you were doing an investigation with a haunted place or not. And they think it's that people have it so ingrained in their heads that if you have an anomalous photo, it means there's, you know, a ghost involved somewhere, that it, you know, just sort of balanced out. None of the image formats or anomalies accurately indicated the haunted areas of the site, and the anomalies of digital and infrared film were worse. Big surprise. Infrared prints had, of course, the highest anomaly rates, and they had a lot of speculation about this. You know, one of which is we just don't know it's normal artifacts yet. And another maybe that we have an inaccurate belief that it's a better format, so we're going to assume, you know, if they've captured something weird looking, it must be paranormal. And it may be a little more susceptible to poor photographic technique, just because we're not familiar with it. You know, not for any other reason. A VPU, and you guys are probably more sophisticated than the bulk of any parapsychologists. There's only a few that actually get into this. But it's very clear it has occurred inside soundproofed Faraday cages that are shielded electromagnetically. It's clearly not just straight radio waves, big surprise. They have very particular speech and sound characteristics. And when you hear, you know, one of the people, a few people in parapsychology has been doing active research on this is Alex McRae over in Scotland. And he started looking at how we analyze EVPs, and he's got this theory that when we hear a response, it takes us a moment to make sense of it. And it doesn't matter whether it's somebody talking to you in person or on the phone or an EVP. It takes you a second to sort of identify what those words mean. And that period of unknowingness is one of tension as you try and figure out what they're trying to say to you. And the more important it is for us to know the answer, the greater the tension during the state of seeing. And that makes sense to me. But what he's seen is a feed-forward expectancy effect. So, to a certain extent, your unconscious mind is trying to help you avoid this tension by offering you solutions very quickly. And you have a limited database that each of us tend to choose from. which can depend on the situation. You know, if you're talking to your Aunt Mabel, you may have a different expectancy set than if you're talking to, you know, say the baby who's just going, So you're going to have different comprehensions of EVP just related to the different expectations. And this can sort of explain sometimes why different people will hear very different things, because they have different expectations with which to match it. And once you've made a match, it's hard to convince people to switch it. This will also explain why skeptics can't hear it. Their expectations say it's impossible. Why would they try to match it? You know, you just go, well, not happening. So it's important to recognize that what you hear may be determined in part by your own expectations, especially for type B and C. The type A's, I think everybody pretty much agrees with. A lot of people for years have talked about the size of Greased Pig contest, but we actually have a lot of pretty solid knowledge about basic effects. One of them that you're going to probably see in your studies is called the decline effect. You keep doing study over and over and over, your results are going to get worse. They're going to trend towards zero. And it's hard to say whether this is just from boredom, because when you're excited and enthused, you really put more energy and effort into it or what. We really don't understand it, but it's a very consistent finding. So in your own research, you may notice this also. You can go, oh, just the decline. Look very impressive. Target type is important to recognize, and I think everybody kind of recognizes this. Anyway, you talk about focusing objects, that certain targets that appeal to you, or I should say to your unconscious mind, will be easier to affect. I know Jack Pop, who started spoon bending parties, and he likes to say he's never seen anyone bend a rusty nail. Nobody likes it. The conscious mind clearly knows how to succeed at something that's been tasked. There have been a lot of parapsychology experiments where you hide what the experiment is, and you ask them to do something else, they can still do the real experiment. Even though they don't know how to do it, or that there is a real experiment, it's not hidden from the unconscious mind. So it's really important to recognize that what you can or cannot do may be more a result of what interests your unconscious mind than of what your potential is. Altered states are important. I will not go through the hundreds, if not thousands, of studies, but they looked at all kinds of altered states. Partial sensory deprivation, which I got interested in because of people on the North Pole and South Pole having experiences. Meditation, hypnosis, dreaming, they all show that psychic abilities are enhanced in altered states. And this includes the edge of sleep, whether you're going off to sleep or waking up. Now, the fact that more ghost activity gets reported at night may be a combination of two things. There is a lower a higher signal-to-noise ratio. Sorry, I thought that typo. Because there's less going on to distract you, you're more able to tune into the paranormal. But also, when you're tired, you're more psychic. Okay? It's not always a disadvantage to be tired when you're going on an investigation, unless you're trying to do poltergeist phenomena, and then it's harder. I don't know, how many of you know about local behavioral time? Okay, let's spend some time. This is one of the few physical factors we found in ESP hybrids. And it's been found in every laboratory around the world in over 20 years worth of data. In fact, once the parapsychologist found out about this, because we were dying for a physical factor, everybody was pouring their data, this body's worth, you know, please look at mine, you know. So they have tons of data on this, and it's a very consistent effect. Now, the term local sidereal time is an astronomy term, and it refers to the fact that you have a planet Earth, and let's see, the sidereal day is the length of time it takes for a star to travel all the way around the planet Earth and reach the same point the star did at. And it's not quite the same as clock time. It's only the same as clock time twice a year. So the beauty of this is, because this is for astronomers, there's lots of free software on the internet. Anybody can download for their computer to calculate it for you. And I recommend you do so. It basically tells you how the planet is oriented relative to the stars in the Milky Way galaxy. Now, the Milky Way galaxy is not like a round sphere. It's more like a flat plate. Okay? and we're sort of on the edge of the plate, and I've got images to try and help show this. Now, why is it important? Because in every experiment they've found so far, there's a repeated pattern of a 300% increase in the hit rate at about 1,330 local cellular time. And there is a zero hit rate, no ESP, at around 1,800 and 1,930. Now, recognize that we do have individual personal biorhythms that can sort of influence our own personal data. But this is really interesting because not only is it seen in the ESP data, but they went back and they looked at one car accidents in countries, you know, like Iceland, you know, where most of the accidents are car versus elk or something, you know. And what they find is there's a decrease in accident rates at 1,300 to 1,330 local cellular time and an increase at 1,800 to 1,930. So we may be using this stuff to help keep us out of accidents and out of trouble. Now, what's really going on? I mocked up all these pictures, okay? That's a stolen Andromeda galaxy, so don't take it too personally. What do we see? When you're looking at 1,300 local cellular time, I've got three different angles. Basically, you're looking, if we're assuming that the galaxy is flat here, and I'm on stay on planet Earth, at 1,300, I'm looking straight up into outer space. There are the fewest stars between me and deep space. If you look at 1,800, you're looking across the entire length of the star field before you get to outer space. They don't know why this is important, but something's going on, and it's a very, very consistent effect. Now, what I try to show below with the color-coded arrows is the actual data that they're finding. And on the side going up and down, you see the effect size. That's how good of ESP results you get. And then across is the local sidereal time. And you can see where the dips and peaks are. You can see it's not exactly a single precise point, but sort of like a range like you might expect as the planet was rotating. Chief code effect. This is a biggie, too. And this was done by Gertrude Schmeidler, who was a psychologist in New York. And she says sheep are psi believers, and they will tend to use their abilities for success at psychic. Okay. Can you even hear me? Is this turned on?
Yeah, it's on. No, but I am.
Thank you, Dave. So psi believers tend to use their abilities for psi hitting or success. Goats will use it for failure. They'll use it to deliberately sabotage their own experiments and get null results. Now, this is really fun if you have an unsophisticated goat for your subjects and you're doing something like ESP cards and you have five possible choices. So you should have 20% hit rate as random chance and they get zero. And they think they've proven you wrong and they've just proven psi. There's nothing finer from my viewpoint. I love those experiments. But if you get a sophisticated skeptic and they know to score an exactly random chance. Now, why is this important? Why do I bring this up now? Robert Rosenthal is a psychologist who's at Harvard. He found in the 1960s that the experimenters a key aspect of their experiment. And they can determine its success or failure. And this is very well known in every form of the biological or behavioral sciences. This is not about sloppy technique or fraud. Recognize that this is saying that it's an unintended effect creating a self-fulfilling prophecy, and it usually occurs through subtle processes of communication. So in other words, you give them subliminal cues or your body language. Seriously, there have been a lot of studies in medical effectiveness of certain drugs, and if you have the doctor handing them the drugs, doesn't believe in the advocacy, they don't have to say a word. The patient knows I'm not supposed to get results from this, and vice versa. In fact, a lot of the original placebo studies were based on this. Now, why is this important? Because we found you can use your psychic abilities in the same way. And experimenters, even if you have no contact whatsoever with your research participants, can affect the outcome of their own studies. So for skeptical experimenters, this means failure to get results. For believers or sheep, it means successful results. And this is why it is critical that any experiment get repeated by others. And why you cannot hoard your own results. If you're getting something, some good finding, you have to make sure someone else can do it, because it may just be you. And the only way to prove it isn't just you is if other people can repeat the same results. Now, I'm going to talk about steering studies for a couple of reasons. Because it does tie into the experimenter effect, and because it's something I think that relates to hunting investigations. Steering studies are where you have one person hooked up in a room to a computer monitor. They're constantly getting measured physiologically, and there are different ways you can do this. The promise one is probably galvanic skin response, like they do on the light detector test, polygraph test. And a lot of times you have a camera steering, but they have a disguise, so you don't know if it's on or off. Then you have another person in an isolated room, and they may be flipping through a magazine, or the computer will say, now pay attention to the picture, you know, the image on the screen, and they'll stare at the person intently, you know, and they'll say, now relax, and you go back to flipping your magazine. And what they find is the person who's being stared at may not consciously know, but their galvanic skin response changes. So on an unconscious level, you know if you're being stared at. And I see no reason why we wouldn't also know if spirits are staring at us. Same thing. Now, I bring this up because there's a wonderful study that just really upset parapsychologists. And it kind of shows the importance of the experimenter effect. And we have two parapsychologists, Marilyn Schlitz, who's a believer, and she has a history of always getting great results. And Richard Weissman, who is a skeptic in England, who never gets results. He always gets exact random chance. Okay? And they were doing the same studies with the same protocols and getting totally opposite results. And they couldn't figure it out. Just frustrating them to death. And so they decided, let's do a study together. And that way we can see if it's just our subjects. You know, maybe British subjects just aren't as psychic as American ones. You know, we'll figure it out. So they each ran half of their tests at their own lab and half of their tests at the other person's lab. These identical protocols, neither of them had anything to do with data collection or analysis that was done independently. Marilyn got all positive results. Richard got no results. That put the cat among the pigeons. All of a sudden, experimenters had to say, am I responsible for my own findings? You know, what's real, what isn't? I'm using my psychic abilities to get what I wanted. Now, poor Dean Radin always gets positive results too, but his studies have been replicated by others. And one of the most interesting right now that you can see if you do the go to YouTube and get the Google pop that Dean Radin did is presentiment. And it's talking about unconscious precognition. So we already knew that we can tell unconsciously because our galvanic skin response changes when someone's staring at us. They're like, what if we can look at precognition the same way? And they found they could. So they already had the setup from the steering studies. They didn't have to set up the labs any differently other than they have a computer that will be randomly choosing a photograph that it will show somebody while they're being physiologically measured. So a person usually sitting by themselves, which is about to start a trial, computer randomly picks a photo. It can be calm, arousing, whether violent, erotic, or food. I'm told food gets some of the best responses. There are gender differences on this too. If you show a violent picture to a woman, she will react strongly, a man will not. So they've discovered, you know, you kind of have to think about your subject. Well, I think that's why they sort of switched over to food. Erotic and calm. The photo shown, and then you have to give a recovery phase, time for things to go back to baseline. What happens? This is real data from some of their studies. I'm going to show two samples of this. This one is an example of photos. At -5 seconds, they push a button and the computer randomly picks an image it's going to show 5 seconds later. You see a difference in response, depending on what kind of photo they're about to be shown. And I sort of did a yellow highlighting to try and show that there's a little gap there. We're not talking about a huge difference, but there's a consistent small difference. But on some level, if they know they're going to be shown something arousing, shall we say, they start preparing ahead. And they're a little bit above the ones that know they're going to see a calm picture. So, again, that at a 0 point, they show the photo, and then you see a huge response after the photo shown. This does not work just with photos. It works with every kind of stimulus. It doesn't matter whether you're using an unpleasant sound, a flash of light, or what. You can also get it with many different kinds of measures. You can get it with pupil size, heart rate, skin conductance, everything from what we can tell. Usually autonomic nervous system, but it can be mixed autonomic and sympathetic. Now again, what are you seeing? About 1 second before the stimulus, they're starting to react. Now people might say, why does it matter? These are very weak effects. They only occurred 1 to 5 seconds ahead of time. Who cares? Well, for one thing, it takes conscious mind out of the equation. There can't be conscious mind fraud. It also proves precognition, even if it's just a short duration, happens. And it may be that it occurs in your investigations, too, if you start looking for it. I think I'd be very interested if you guys, tell me you were hooked up and phenomena happened and you were starting to respond just before it happened. It'd be an interesting study. Nobody's looked at it. And again, why would this matter? Well, if you have a saber-toothed tiger about to jump down on you, that extra second could make the difference between survival and death. So it makes perfect sense why we would have this sort of hardwired into us, potentially. It gives you an edge by preparing you for what's about to happen. Very good research, and it's been done by many, many different experiments around the world. So it is a real effect. Now, consciousness can affect matter. That's pretty clear. There have been a lot of studies. But let's talk about some of the newer ones. Presented last month. Gary Schwartz, who did the afterlife experiments. He's gotten tired of the flack he got from working with mediums, and he switched to physics experiments. He's now looking at gamma radiation. And he's using cameras that are cooled to a 77 degree below zero temperature in a sealed metal chamber with only a white sheet of paper inside. And he's putting that inside a temperature-controlled and light-controlled room. And he's giving 30-minute exposure times to try and record gamma radiation. What happens? The upper one, I don't know if you can see it, it has randomly scattered dots, and that is what you normally get in a control run. If you have a meditator that you ask to put consciousness inside the box, you get a white streak. And it actually looks like all the dots suddenly coalesce in the middle. Now, he's not sure whether this means entropy is decreased or, you know, technically maybe they're affecting the camera itself, but something interesting is going on, and it's clearly related to consciousness that's going on in a way that can be physically measured. Now, double slit experiments are like a classic. It's like vanilla and chocolate ice cream to physics. Everybody's gone. And what you have is you have a laser that shoots through a filter, and then you have a double slit. You have one photon, close slits open, you'll get what they call a double slit pattern, which is sort of like a wobble here. If you block one slit, you'll get a left slit pattern. If you block the other slit, you get a right slit pattern. Known physical effects. What happens if you have a meditator and you ask them to block a slit? It gives you a block slit pattern. Physical effects. And this is being done right now by Dean Radin, Paul Winland, and Robert Rickenbach. I think they're hoping to publish it in the mainstream physics journal very shortly. Now, where it gets really interesting is it appears that you can do this retrocausal. In other words, you do the experiment, and then later you say to the meditator, go back in time and block that slit. And you look at the data, and the data that was already recorded before you asked anyone to do anything shows the block slit pattern. Interesting studies. So consciousness appears to be able to affect an outcome after it has already occurred, if it's not been observed. And by the way, there are a lot of other studies that kind of show this. I sometimes wonder if this is what happens with EDP, that we're recording some of it, you know, after the fact. One of the emerging theories about DSP, and this is something Jim Carpenter has been talking about, he's with Ryan, is that we use psychic information all the time. It gets a first look at everything, all the time. And the purpose of the unconscious mind is not to acquire psychic information, but to block it out if it's irrelevant. So it's acting as a filter so that you only get the relevant stuff, so you don't get flooded with the stuff that doesn't matter to your organism. And he says we use this information unconsciously to navigate through life all the time, to help bring the experiences we want to us, avoid the experiences we don't, on an unconscious level, which is not always what the conscious mind would agree with. And I would say we also do this with mind-matter interaction. I would extend it. I think that how often have we affected computers and other things, and you go, just go, oh, that's stupid. That's why you didn't yell at my computer. You know, I know I do mind-matter. I blow light bulbs if I'm angry. I try never to get angry. I keep lots of spirits around. And this is one of his slides. And what he's trying to say with this is that when you have a conscious perception, that's the bottom gold one, it's a mix of things that go into that. Some of them are conscious experience, conscious thoughts. Some of them are subliminal material and maybe psychic. Let's look at mind matter through. Keen Raiden loves to blow people's minds. And he's looked at how you can explain mind matter. And he said there's four basic explanations. You can say it's selective reporting. In other words, you only report the studies that give you the results you want to ignore the others. And pretty clearly that doesn't happen because we'd have had to have done millions more studies than we've been able to do to get that result. So otherwise you can have causal moving forward through time. So I want to cause an event, I push it forward in time. Okay? Or you can have precognition. It's all passive. You just go, I know I have to do this to get that result. And then passively it's just going to go there. Okay? The third option, right through a mind matter, says, I have an intention now, I set it in the future, and then it pulls me towards it. Okay? And then he said, let's look at the data. And so he used mathematical equations to figure out what you would need for each of these. The green line is if it is a push forward through time. The blue line is if it just sort of passively happens, if you chose it right. And what you actually see with the data is closest to the red line, which is you create an intention which pulls you towards it. And this may explain how the secret works. It's using mind-matter interaction. And that's real data on the black. So it does look to be the way that my matter interaction, we're not talking about things that are spinning necessarily, but other things may be happening. In terms of emerging concepts, time is a very hot topic in, I think, physics, philosophy, and parapsychology right now. And we're starting to realize that a lot of the equations involving time, if you actually look at the mathematical formulas, there's no reason they should be asymmetrical. They're symmetrical formulas. So if things move forward in time, there's no reason they can't equally well move backwards in time. And they're starting to see more physics experiments that are saying maybe things do go both directions in time. And I would also point out it could explain levitation, because when you affect time, by definition, if you look at the formula, you're affecting the mass or the weight of something with gravity. So maybe that's how levitation works. We're also starting to question other types of the laws of thermodynamics. And this is not parapsychologists. This is physicists, such as whether it's really true that entropy always has to increase, which is the second law of thermodynamics, which my dad made me learn in the second or third grade. Changing. Now, I think there's some real untapped areas of research that I would like to see you guys help with. Nobody's looking at why batteries don't work. How often do you hear about batteries suddenly not working? And I know the term we commonly use is drainage, but it's not really drainage because when the mind matter stops, they're reading full again. I mean, I know I've had that experience where I'm walking with my flashlight, the flashlight dies. I'm thinking, I couldn't put batteries. and I see a ghost. The ghost disappears, my flashlight comes back on. Is that a field effect? Is that what the UFO people are reporting? You know, what's going on? Nobody's looking at that. Everybody reports equipment malfunction. You're trying to take a picture. Polaroid. Don't take a picture. You know? Ghost goes away. All of a sudden, takes pictures fine. You know? Everyone reports it. Is it our online matter to let us know something's going on? Is it deliberate and specific? Is it a field effect? I don't know that anybody has really looked at this. And you guys are doing a lot of investigations. You have a lot of good equipment. And you've got good basic techniques. I say it'd be very interesting to see what you guys could find. I'm going to leave you with some major take-home messages. Consciousness clearly has a documented effect on matter. We've seen this in experiment after experiment. We're talking normal physics experiments. And it's very clear that it happens. And it may also be able to reverse entropy, hard to say, and affect time. Now, computers and electronic equipment are a favorite target for psi experiments. What does that tell you when you're using computers and electronics in the field? It could be your own target. It's our favorite thing to use for psi experiments. Because they're easy to affect. Everyone can do ESP and mind matter. And I swear, you know, I don't know why people get in their heads that you do research with strokes. Almost all of the parapsychological research is done with college kids you've dragged into the lab and they were required to take, you know, do so many hours of lab stuff in order to meet their psychology requirements, you know. You drag people off the street, they're ordinary people, and they can do it. Now, it may take statistics to see it if it's not relevant to them, but they can do it. How you use your ability depends on what you want to accomplish, whether consciously or unconsciously. How many of you guys want to get findings? I do. You know, for skeptics, this can mean getting no findings. And for believers, it can mean getting cool results. You don't need to know anything at all about a device to be able to successfully manipulate it. All you need is an unconscious intention. Conscious mind does not need to be involved at all. I know parapsychologists are now trying to, before they do their experiments, it's really funny. They will meditate, go, I will get the true results, I will get the true results. I don't know if it works, because your unconscious mind is the guy driving the bus. There can be a field effect where tight items near the target can be impacted, and sometimes also there can be sort of a spread across time. Like if you're doing metal bending studies, that the metal will continue to bend for 3 days afterwards. It seems to be a bit of a field effect. At this time, with what we have now, and that could be changing, I've got my fingers crossed, equipment can't provide proof of ghosts. There's just no way to know the source of your findings. Even if the living are responsible for their own equipment readings, whether artifact or mind matter, it doesn't mean that a ghost isn't also present. I don't know why people get that stuck in a skeptic's life to say, no ghosts. Your subjective experiences are a critical part of any investigation. And it's sort of interesting, if you look at parapsychology today, when I first did my dissertation, I won't say how many years ago, I was probably only about the second phenomenological study that had been done. Now about half of the research they talk about is experiential. And we're starting to realize the importance of the personal meaning and the insight you get from your own experience. Never put that down, that you can't show that to somebody else. This is another cartoon I did. We have forms. Temperature drops. Wow, look at that. We didn't even do anything. They're having a good time. You may be the one creating your own findings with equipment, not the ghost. Doesn't mean they're not there. We just don't know who's responsible. Does this mean equipment findings are worthless? No, absolutely not. Do not take that message home. Regardless of the source of these findings, living or dead, they do indicate psi. Someone's doing something interesting. And they may also represent the physical or energetic, I don't know, we don't fully understand yet. It's still worthwhile. But what I would say is be careful what you claim to others. And keep an open mind about the precise nature and meaning of your results. Also, I'm going to say this over and over again. The experimenter effect means other people have to find the same things for us to know that it's really real. So you really want to involve other people, get them to do the same experiments you did, similar protocols, see what do they find. Do they get results? Do they not? So at this point, equipment findings don't represent proof of ghosts any more than subjective experiences. I don't think that is a negative on equipment, but a positive on subjective experiences. I think they're very meaningful. But this is a conundrum that frustrates and stymies parapsychology today. And so a lot of them have turned away from survival research. It is hoped that with changes in science, this will change. And publishing the results where others can read them is, you know, it benefits everybody. If you want to learn more about parapsychology for ESP, I would recommend as a starter book The Conscious Universe by Dean Radin. Very readable. Don't skip the introduction. It's hysterical. He's a very witty guy. My book is the only real book about mind matter. Handbook to Parapsychology if you want detailed research. It's a 1976 book. Still has a lot of great stuff in it. And the website for the Parapsychological Association is parapsych.org. I also want to mention that very, very recently, in fact, I only knew about this when I went to the PA last month, Coventry University is starting to offer 100% online postgraduate programs in parapsychology. They're primarily offering masters, but you can get a doctorate if you want. This is legitimate, real parapsychology. You've got to do the work. If you go to the online parapsychology library, and I know that's a horrible link, but if you go to my website, every page of my website has a link to the online parapsychology library. You just have to look on the left-hand side under links. It also has links to the main Parapsychological Association website. And these are all the journals and the years of editions that they have. You can read the 1884 first journal ever of the Journal for Society of Psychical Research. How cool is that? And this is text searchable. You can search every single one of these journals at the same time for whatever topic interests you. Now, this is one of the things that used to hold parapsychology back. No one knew the research. So you kept reinventing the wheel. You kept doing the same studies over instead of building on what was there in the past. So this is a subscription library. It's open to everybody. And I really recommend it. About the only journal it doesn't currently have, and I suspect that will change eventually, is the journal, the Australian Journal of Parapsychology. It has all of those other journals. Text searchable. Can you tell I find that exciting? this is my next book, and I will just leave that up there while I take questions. I've tried to get this pointed. Not bad. I'm after one. Questions. Oh, and people who ask good questions get chocolate. Let me try again. Oh, I'm not a good thrower. What?
Oh, sorry. Under hypnosis, you affect your unconscious mind to cause a certain intent?
You negotiate with it, but you can come to an agreement.
So what do you do? If you're under hypnosis, can you do it, or
do you? I do self-hypnosis all the time. It's cool. I really recommend everybody learn hypnosis if you're interested in parapsychology. It's an altered state of consciousness that does enhance your psychicness. And it's very educational to learn about your own unconscious. You can go for the called idiomotor, where you ask your unconscious to twitch a finger for yes and any other finger for no. You can start asking it questions and negotiating and talking to it. Very useful.
Are there particular books that you would recommend on self-hypnosis?
I don't know. You might know better.
Okay.
Dr. Goldberg.
Okay.
I actually have a dual specialization in my doctorate degree. So I did over 300 hours training in hypnosis. And it's really cool. you know. And not just from a paranormal viewpoint, but things you can change in your own life. You know, we saw people with road rage that would fly in like Gandhi, you know. It's just really interesting. Yeah. Mine, as a parapsychologist,
right.
I think chasing around a table is really cool. When you have a heavy wood table that you're racing, you know, and all your fingertips are on top, and it's summer in a Florida day, so everyone's in short sleeves, you know, and nobody's got their hands under the table, and the table is flying around the room, that is cool. You know, clearly I'm parapsychological material. That is cool. I didn't figure out, I was like, that is cool. Yeah. You've already got two. I won't give you another.
That's right. On the topic of MMI,
yeah.
How does that relate to things like Reiki or where people claim to be able to transfer energy from one person to another?
I have opinions about Reiki I should probably not make public. I actually trained as a novice healer with the Spiritualist Church for about 6 months. And what I like about the training I got is we learned probably 30 different ways of healing. And you can tailor the technique to the individual patient and their needs. And I guess what bothers me sometimes about Reiki is it does seem to be sort of a cookie cutter, one size fits all kind of a thing. And that bothers me a little bit. But it certainly, from an intention viewpoint, if you have an intention that they get better, it doesn't necessarily, you know, and you're using this as a ritual, there's no reason why you might not be able to use your own beliefs to affect it. And I will say, as a healer, I've had no trouble affecting things back in time as well as forward. Like, I'm going to be busy, so I'll set the intention ahead of time that somebody will do it quickly after surgery, or I promised somebody I would take care of their cold and I forgot, so I go back in time to do it. And it does seem to work at the time you intended it to work. Because I checked. I like to experiment. Yeah.
Well, I had a weird... the first time I ever had Reiki done on me, a co-worker placed his hands on my chest. He's like, close your eyes. Puts his hands on my chest. And then I hear his voice across the room, and I open my eyes, and he had walked across the room, but it still felt like his hands were on my chest.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa. That was crazy.
I love experiences. Other questions? Everyone wants to go to lunch?
Why are you so pretty, Pamela Heath?
Ask questions.
Top of the table, she's got two copies of the PK film up. She's got one copy of Rousseau's Theodore.